Attacks of September 11th have added real urgency to that debate. But tonight we'd like to expand the frame of the discussion. How does American foreign policy affect us right here in central Illinois? What does it mean for our two main industries, education and agriculture? Do communities like Urbana or Normal or Decatur or Danville need to prepare for a terrorist attack? To discuss these issues, we have four guests. Earl Kellogg is the Associate Provost for International Affairs at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He's a leading authority on the international dimension of the university. Hamish Gao is Assistant Professor of International Agribusiness at the U of I. He's done research on the agricultural and food industries in many places around the world, including Eastern Europe and South America. Richard Janey is the director of the Illinois Fire Service Institute. It's based at University of Illinois. He's a retired Marine colonel and has dealt with terrorism issues for some 20 years. He also serves on the State of Illinois Terrorism Task Force. And Tom Arkell is an attorney. He specializes in immigration law. He's a member of the Association of International Educators and the American Immigration Lawyers Association. His office is in Bloomington, Illinois. As we talk, you should be thinking about the questions that you would like to ask, and we will give you the chance to do that a little later in the program. As part of this America in the World project, WILL organized a series of community outreach events to get people talking about a range of issues, including immigration, security, and agricultural policy. And we produced two short packages to set out some ideas for discussion. In this first segment, we consider the experiences of foreign students at the University of Illinois. Last fall, over 4,700 foreign students were enrolled at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. That's the seventh largest enrollment of international students in the United States. When these students leave the university and return home, what will they take with them in addition to their degree?
I certainly want them to have a positive impression of the United States overall. I would want them to have a good experience here because these are people who are going to go home and who, because of their education and their opportunities and maybe their background or whatever, they're most likely going to have positions of influence.
When I go home, one of the first few things I'll tell them is that, you know what, not everyone really likes Bush there. And you know what, not everyone really is your token Republican Texan.
What I told my relatives is that Americans have very good intentions. They just seem to be going around, they're not going about it in the most peaceful way.
The foreign policy of the U.S., you know, affects us a lot in the Middle East, especially. There's a lot of suspicion. A lot of my Pakistani friends especially were severely affected by September 11th. They were unable to get visas. They were, there was a lot of criticism about how, you know, whether they should be allowed in.
Many universities have reported a decline in applications by foreign students. Officials at the University of Illinois say their numbers are up, despite the fact that regulations have made it more difficult for foreign students to come to this country. Some here have started to refer to this new reality as the culture of no.
The culture of no is a memorandum that came down from the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. And basically what this memo said was that you better not be the officer that awards a change of classification or an extension of classification to a terrorist.
The biggest change since 2001 for people who work in international student offices is that all of our regulatory bases have been flipped upside down.
The biggest change is the time it takes to do everything. A process that probably should take a year is evolving to a year and a half, 2 years.
My school totally changed its view from allowing, from persuading students to try, you know, the Canadian track or the UK track, maybe even the Australian track.
Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do, and I think I'd like to start out with Professor Kellogg, because a number of people that we talked to said something that I thought was very interesting, the idea that foreign students, when they come here to the University of Illinois, will eventually they'll go back to their countries of origin, and they well may be government leaders, at the very least opinion leaders in their countries, and that the impression that they form of the United States and their experience here will, in the long run, affect the relationship between the United States and their country and others. And I wonder whether, in fact, you think that that is true.
I do think it's true, David. It's true because Many of these students are involved in American society in lots of ways other than in their classroom. And so they begin to appreciate the ability to speak one's mind and point of view, and they begin to understand the complexities of American society, as you heard one of them indicate on the TV show, and they get to know people in their own homes. And I travel a great deal for the University of Illinois, and some of that is to speak with alumni of this university. And they're very loyal, they're very enthusiastic about this university and their experiences in the United States. So mm-hmm. I think it is an important investment for the United States to make available high-quality education to students from other countries.
Well, obviously, foreign students and foreign faculty are also an important resource for the university. What could you imagine if something happened that it made it that severely cut into the numbers of foreign students and faculty here at the university? What would it mean for the university?
Well, it would be a very serious problem for this university because, as also indicated on the tape, we have a large number of international students on our campus. But they're here because they are excellent students, and we have a larger proportion of them in the graduate programs where they are recruited for their research and teaching expertise. And there are graduate programs at the University of Illinois that would be severely hampered if there weren't international students here. There are research programs that would be severely hampered if there weren't international students here. But as important and sometimes not as well understood, it's important for our students who are in the classroom to have opportunities to get to know each other. People look at things differently from other parts of the world, and this is going to be an increasingly interdependent world, and part of our educational process needs to be understanding others' viewpoints, mm-hmm. seeing what's happening in the other part of the world and how that's perceived by other people. And that's going to be a reality for us in the next several decades. And our students ought to be learning that in the classrooms and in their interactions with students from other parts of the world. So it's a very valuable resource in that sense, too.
Well, here I'd like to turn to our immigration attorney, because having made the point that foreign students to faculty are an important resource, and that we believe that movement of people, if we say that that's a good thing, well, it's important for us to, I would say, to do what we can to make it easy for students to come here to study and for people to come here to be faculty members. And also the impression that you get from talking to people who deal in this area is that, particularly over the last couple of years, since September 11th of 2001, it is more difficult. Is that in fact true? I mean, have the regulations been tightened to the point where it's now more difficult for people to come to be students or to come to the university?
Yeah, there's no question that it's become more difficult since September 11th for international students to study and come to the United States. The visa denial rates for, in particular, Chinese and Indian students in the last year have increased substantially. I believe it was 45% for Chinese students and 35% for Indian students. And one of the primary reasons for it is that it's a consular official who interviews the students, and in a very short period of time, that consular official will make a determination whether or not he or she believes the international student is actually going to return to their country of origin at the completion of their studies. And sometimes that decision is made very quickly, and as a result, many of these international students are denied access to the United States and are not allowed to study here, at least when they planned on studying here. Many times they'll apply again, but it has definitely become more difficult for international students to be admitted into the United States.
Well, that sounds to me not necessarily like a security issue, but maybe some other kind of issue. Is the reason that it's been tightened have something to do with the perception that these people might constitute some threat in a political sense, or does this more have to do with economics?
I think a lot of it has to do with the culture of no that was referenced in the introductory segment. That now, with the increased security, there's also more pressure that's placed on consular officials and government employees who have to make decisions as to whether or not to admit somebody into the United States. And many of these employees and officials do not want to be the individual who makes the wrong decision and admits somebody who could potentially be a terrorist. Of course, the vast majority of students who come to this country pose absolutely no threat to the country, but if a consular official or an immigration official has to make a decision whether to admit somebody and they have a question as to whether or not that person could potentially pose a threat, I think what's happening now are these officials are making the decision, which is the safest decision for them, which is simply to say no.
Yeah. Professor Keller, you want to comment on further?
Yes, there's a considerable amount of evidence that indicates there's also a great concern about economic immigration. And that's one of the reasons that, particularly from China, that the consular officials tell us, at least, that they say no. There's a strong interest in making certain that people go back to the country of origin, and if they can't prove that in a very solid way, it's often no, you can't have a visa. So it's not only the crime and terrorism issue, it's economic integration issue.
I want to ask Dick Cheney your thoughts on this, because certainly immigration is a national security issue. It always was. We're much more sensitive now to just how great an issue it is. And do you think that have we overreacted in making decisions about who can come to the University of Illinois or to the United States?
I think that's a fair question. I think we'll know over time. I think it may be too early to know whether the answer is yes or no to that question. But what I would say is that I think we, 9/11 or September 11th or whatever we call it, really was the beginning of a new strategic period for the United States, in the same way that the late 1940s was the beginning of a new strategic period, in that the relationships and immigration policy had largely been through the Cold War about relationships between nations and between alliances. And now we're talking about non-nation actors who are threats to our national security. And so we're having to deal with individuals. Now, when you retool a system from nations to individuals, that is a pretty substantial retooling. And that, in many ways, is what we're trying to find a balance in. How do we base foreign policy on the relationships between nations, but deal with individuals who aren't controlled or represent those nations, but could represent a strategic threat to the United States, as opposed to perhaps a criminal or lesser threat? Mm-hmm. And arguably, 9/11 represented a strategic threat when you have the kinds of devastation and so on that was affected both to the economy and to human life. That's not a minor issue. So I think resetting that calculus is the answer to your question, and I'm not sure we have an answer right now.
I don't know, Professor Gow, if you have some particular thought about this, but I guess I'm interested in whether you do, and particularly if during the course of your teaching and research you have contact with foreign students and how they, anything that they might tell you about how they feel about this.
Well, I think that the key one is on this is, since World War II, education and opportunity for foreigners to come to America and learn about America and the potential economic benefits that individuals gain, as well as what they take back to their own country, has been a huge boom for us as far as foreign policy goes, because they take back an understanding about what America's about, how it operates. They have the opportunity to go back to those countries and link into America and develop economically within those countries and then link that to America. And by closing that opportunity, we're closing out one of our largest and most beneficial groups of ambassadors for America. And those individuals, rightly so now, will be looking to go elsewhere. So they'll be going back to the UK, they'll be going to somewhere in Europe, Australia or New Zealand. And so our best ambassadors, who, if they're graduate students, they can spend anywhere between 5 and 10 years here understanding America from inside America and in a range of different locations. We're going to lose those ambassadors. And the worst thing is the two largest economies in the world are India and China, and they're the two ones who are getting knocked back on their visas all the time, and they're the ones who we need to have the ambassadors in there, which we get through education.
Well, I'm sure that we'll continue with some of these issues, but I'd like to make a little jump here at this point to something else. And as I did mention back at the beginning of the program, this past spring and summer, WILL held a series of community events to try to get people talking about foreign policy issues and what they mean to us here in central Illinois. One of these events took place at the Champaign County Farm Bureau, and as you no doubt would expect, it focused on agriculture and trade policy. Here are some of the comments from that event.
the effects of agriculture, the effects of world markets, the effects of international policy on agriculture, and how that impacts the 15th District is dramatic, not only in terms of farmers themselves, but on businesses that are specifically or indirectly reliant on a strong agricultural community for their viability.
It used to be that we didn't have to concern ourselves maybe so much with foreign policy in the early parts of this century and at the end of the last, because we primarily traded with ourselves. Our agriculture was local and it stayed local. And now we export more than 33%, and in Illinois it's closer to 40% depending on which crop.
And so no longer can we keep putting up a fence around our markets and try to keep people out from competing, nor maybe should we want to, because when you have competition, when you have opportunities, people become much more entrepreneurial and make investments in very interesting ways.
A brief comment about Iraq. I think we blew all that good feeling we had from the rest of the world pretty quickly in the last 15 months or so. We could have used that. That's the kind of good feeling we need to advance our good efforts in the world, to advance our trade, if you will.
It seems to me that we should begin to think in terms of how agricultural policy becomes a part, a necessary but not sufficient part, of a larger strategy to make certain that we don't have a lot of failed states around the world that become the feeding grounds for both international crime or terrorism.
There in that particular segment, and we made a number of fairly big leaps, but I think that you can actually connect those dots. Certainly an important initial point, agriculture, vital industry to us here. Trade, exports, extremely important now, more than ever before. We have to survive in a world global market now. But the interesting point here, I think, was the one that Ed Colliger makes there right at the end, makes the connection between there, our ability to export, to feed other people, to participate in that global market, and makes that connection between there and peace and stability. Do you think that's a reasonable kind of connection to make, or is that too far a jump?
No, I think that's definitely a fair one to make. If we don't work out how we can raise incomes in developing countries around the world, we're not going to solve the hunger problem, and we're going to get an adverse reaction from those individuals against countries which are effectively blocking their market access for individuals in those countries. And if you go to the developing world, and Earl can answer this better than I can, there's a large percent of the population lives there below $2 a day. And they live in rural communities, and the only way that we can help them raise their incomes is solve their income problem, which is going to be through agriculture. And so we have to open up our markets to agricultural products and help facilitate their access into world marketplaces so we can raise their incomes, solve their hunger problems, and therefore solve a whole lot of our security problems around the world.
In addition to this role that you have now about thinking about the university and the international world, you're an agricultural economist, right? So this definitely taps into your background.
Well, Hamish has an excellent point there, that many of these countries that we refer to as low-income countries or developing countries have significant agriculture sectors. And there's just no way you're going to get sustained economic growth in those countries without finding ways to improve their agricultural productivity and improving non-farm employment for people in those rural areas who will have to be migrating out of that farm area. So this is a very important point, and one that sometimes gets glossed over, that one of the keys to raising incomes and to further food security and international security is to find a way to fight poverty and hunger in these developing countries. Mm-hmm. A world in which there are now about 3 billion people who live on less than $2 a day, that's nearly half of the world's population, is not a stable world. It's not a world that is characterized by justice and peace. And we've got to find ways to deal with that.
Let me very quickly here tell people who are watching that in a few moments we'll be happy to start taking your phone calls. Perhaps already you have some questions or comments you'd like to make, and we'd certainly like to hear from you. The number is 333-3495. The area code is 217. You can call now if you like, and it just as soon as we get some people lined up, I'm sure we'd be happy to hear what you have to say. Do you think that it's true, as the one gentleman, the farmer who stood up and spoke at that forum at the Farm Bureau said, that specifically because what we have done here over the last couple of years, foreign policy decisions that we have made, has that made it more difficult for American farmers to export to the world market? Hamish, do you
know? I'll have a crack at that one. I think there's a really interesting debate which is going on at the moment, and it's going to come to a head between subsidies and supports to agriculture and big business in North America and big business in Europe. We've got a saturated market here for our products, whether it's agricultural products or manufactured products, because everyone's got basically what they want, and so it's a substitution issue. And all the development of the consumer base is all overseas, and that's in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Asia. And big business needs to go into those countries and work out how they can go in there. And it's an issue for them about intellectual property rights and how they protect that. And we've got a question here within agriculture where we're trying to protect our markets. And up until now with the trade policies, we've been able to separate agriculture from big business. But we're supporting agriculture with less than 1% of our federal budget in North America. And large business needs to be able to drive our economy. And we're going to come into a battle very soon where Brazil is going to become the feed basket for Asia. And Asia is just going to go straight to there. If we don't develop policies which work for them, they'll just remove themselves from the WTO and we'll lose access into those marketplaces because they'll just borrow the technology from us and never pay us for it. And so that puts a really interesting perspective on global trade and policy as far as we go forward into the future, both as far as individuals, as far as protection goes, and big business.
But does that really connect with politics? I mean, if the Chinese want to buy soybeans, really, what do they care about what our policy in the Middle East is? Or do they?
Well, they certainly do care about it in many ways, but with respect to specific purchases of exports, it may not be as big a factor, but clearly the ability to have a healthy and continuing relationship with nations is extraordinarily important when you get into trade negotiations, when you get into negotiations that affect the economics of both countries and the commercial interplay between the two. So it is clear that foreign policy does affect these issues, and it's one that's hard to pin down in a specific way. But there are a number of, as Hamish indicated, a number of places one can go for various kinds of goods and services. And the kind of overall foreign policy perspective that countries have of ours makes them more or less willing to do that.
Dick, you want to?
Well, I just suggest that there's a difference between the relationships within the WTO between, for example, European Union and the United States as major trading partners, and that developing world that's on the have-not side. Because one of the issues made in your introduction tape was about removing the seedbeds of terrorism by helping those who are what I would call in a hopeless state, a Sudan, a Somalia, places in the world where they're not part of the WTO and they're really not going to be part of intellectual property. They're starving and they need the capacity to sustain themselves. And I think foreign policy has to answer that specific question now, because those are the terrorists of the future, because they have no reason not to be. And they're terrorists simply because they have to do something to survive, and violence is one of the means in which you acquire things for survival. In that world, that's not a new issue.
Yeah.
The connectivity of that process to a system of organized crime and terrorism that generates over $1 trillion of illegal economies annually adds to the global challenge in that process, that there is money in that process. You just look at the poor farmer in Colombia trying not to grow cocaine. It doesn't work. if they want you to grow cocaine, you have two choices. You can basically grow it or, you know, not survive. And so I think that's a security issue that goes to the heart of how food and so on can be put together. I think that's a separate issue, but they're all interrelated as well.
I would agree in the sense that this is a very important part of the broader and longer-term picture. I think, too, though, we have to realize that some of this hatred of the United States and terrorism as we see it has to do with the way we've been conducting certain kinds of foreign policy and certain kinds of decisions and actions that we've taken. So there's, I think Dick has talked about the longer range, and then there's the shorter range problems. So they're both involved in this question and very, very important. But there are some very specific kinds of short-term sorts of decisions we've made that have fed this kind of hatred.
Well, I think that we're starting to get some calls from some folks who'd like to be part of the conversation. Why don't we start in and we'll talk with someone. The caller is in Mawikwa, and this is line number two, I believe. Hello.
Good evening. My question relates to the government's apparent emphasis on trying to control students or folks that are coming in for legal purposes, as compared to the fact that we've got estimates that there are 4,000 people entering the United States illegally each day, and the fact that some of those people are coming in because of jobs either in agriculture or in agricultural processing. We see fruit and vegetables clearly have a large foreign content in employees. We're starting to see that shift in livestock, and we see that very clearly in the meat processing industry. And how does the government policy that they want to ensure cheap employees compete with the security needs of trying to control the number of people that are entering illegally and not worrying about going through the right channel?
I think it's an interesting question. Anybody can respond, but I'm particularly interested, maybe because you were the fellow that we asked here to talk a little bit, at least about specifically about immigration issues. Do you think the basic premise is true, that perhaps we have spent more time on what it is we do with people who are trying to come in legally and haven't put the resources that perhaps we should into the issue of people who are coming illegally?
Well, since September 11th, there have been substantial resources that have moved away from the benefits portion of immigration, where immigration focuses on bringing families together or facilitating the transfer of individuals into the United States for employment purposes, to enforcement. They formed the Department of Homeland Security. They've tried to beef up security both on the Canadian border and on the Mexican border. So there has been a shift in policy to try and prevent illegal immigration into the United States, but it's such a huge problem. People are always going to want to come into the United States because of the resources that are here. The economy that is here in the United States is second to none in the world, and people want to come into this country to work here. And the caller, I think, is talking about policy with regard to immigration, and with regard to illegal immigration, the policy is enforcement to try and prevent people from coming in illegally, but most policy is directed towards legal immigration as far as facilitating the entry of people into the United States. Before 9/11, there were talks between the United States and Mexico about opening up immigration to people who had entered illegally, but after 9/11, those talks quickly stopped, and since then, again, it's been enforcement.
So, certainly, illegal immigration is a security issue, security of borders. Do you think that we're doing what we should be doing to try to make sure that those people, for whatever reason, are coming into the United States illegally?
I think immigration is a huge issue, and I honestly believe that the system is trying to find stasis between the traditional things that we've sought for immigration to do: feed jobs, provide opportunities for people, maintain those global relationships that are part of our national tradition, and balance that against there's a handful of people out there, however large that hand is, who are using that mechanism to attack us. And the truth of the matter is, the terrorist is, or criminals, look at our systems and try and find workarounds, try and find weaknesses in the systems. It's an asymmetric, if you would, competition. Cold War was all about symmetry. And so we're trying to redefine our national security strategy in dealing with asymmetric non-nation threats. And the policies and mechanisms we have were all mechanisms that were created in a different era. And I think that's the great challenge for the Department of Homeland Security, if you would, is how do I take all these desperately different organizations and retool them to meet the security challenges that I currently face in the United States, whether that's fusion centers or technical connectivities between law enforcement and intelligence people, or it's things like immigration and so on. So it is a huge question, and I wouldn't pretend that it's all correct at this point. I don't think anyone believes it is. But I do believe it's an important part of the calculus. And to say one is preferred over the other is really the basis of the question. How much of one or the other do we, how much security and how much opportunity do we want to balance through our immigration policies, through our foreign policies, through our trade policies, through our relationships with other countries and other organizations? I think that's the big question we're facing right now.
Well, again, we're certainly interested in questions from people who are watching. It can be on any of the issues that we've dealt with so far. Perhaps it could be something different. As long as it's related, that's certainly welcome. Again, that's 333-3495. That is the number to call. 217 is the area code. I'd like to stay with Dick Cheney just for a moment and talk about something different, something that we haven't touched on yet, but something that certainly you deal with because, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, you've been involved with the State of Illinois' Terrorism Task Force and have been first appointed back when the governor was George Ryan and again under Mr. Blagojevich, and partly by virtue of your association with the Fire Service Institute. I think that as people think about what happened on September 11th, obviously people feel that that was an attack not just on the people of New York, but on all of the United States. Sure. And at the same time, I would guess that there are people who live in a lot of the small communities that are watching us that would think the chances of a terrorist attack happening in their community are small. Urbana, Danville, Bloomington Normal, Decatur, I'm sure folks would think, well, terrorists are not going to attack Decatur. Right. Now, is that a reasonable assumption? That in fact, it's not really something that we have to worry about in our part of the country.
Well, I think the question presumes that terrorism is somehow uniquely different than all of the other major events that might occur. And that is not the basis upon which the Terrorism Task Force has invested whatever federal and state monies have been allocated. We look at major events that are of catastrophic impact to the community. Could be natural, could be an accident, could be a labor strike, could be a terrorist or criminal activity. And just this year, for example, in Utica, a tornado struck, collapsed a building. There were people inside who were trapped. And the exact same teams that we have created over the last couple of years to do rescues in Oklahoma City kinds of scenarios, nine of those teams were brought into Utica to save those people. A law enforcement mutual aid plan that was created was put into effect to provide better security, better access to them. The emergency management of that whole process with incident command teams came in to take over so that the direction of those activities could continue day and night. Still had 52 cameras and 24 media trucks show up, and how do you manage the information for communities? And we saw exactly those issues in 9/11 in New York and Washington. You had to communicate with people. You had to bring in resources from outside. You had to do different kinds of responses. So I think it is germane to a community in Illinois, in Eliopolis, that had a massive destruction. It was an accident, but what's the difference? Mm-hmm. In terms of you still had to evacuate the town. You still had three deadly chemicals that were released. And you still had to protect citizens, and you still had to house them, and so on and so forth. So the entire system that was really put in motion before 9/11 in the state of Illinois and has become a model, in my judgment, for the country, and that's not my words, that's Tom Ridge's words and others, was about how do we help our communities regardless of what the source of the event is, when those communities' capacity to deal with whatever has happened to them exceeds their resources. And that's the state system that I think everybody has to plug into. Now, that's not a big foreign policy issue. It's about how do we look inward as opposed to outward. But I think that's part of the new national security definition, is what happens in our communities now is of national importance to our country.
Let's go to another caller here. We have someone in Champaign line 2. Let's talk with them. Hello.
Is that I'm on?
Yes.
Okay, well, we want to keep people abroad having a positive attitude towards us so that we can sell and so on, and so that terrorism will be reduced. But we have been so incompetent in the way we have been dealing with these people. Just to give you a few examples, we sent half as many people as we should have to Iraq. We weren't able to seal the borders. We were not able to prevent looting. We were not able to control the atomic-making equipment that they have there. So when we are that incompetent, and then we send 400,000 Iraqis back home with their weapons, it's just unbelievable how incompetent we have been. So if we are that incompetent, how can people have a good opinion of us?
I'm not sure how well we can talk about that. Anybody want to pick up on the point?
I don't disagree with anything you said. I think our challenge is, what do you do now? Mm-hmm. In the Mideast, in Beirut, I was in and out of Beirut the last part of the 1980s. We had already had two embassies destroyed. You had Hezbollah and Hamas in Syria. You had Syrian intrusions. We had all kinds of issues. How do you now deal with the equation you're facing? And I think that's the question. And there's no question, I think, in anybody's mind that there were certainly miscalculations about what would happen after the ground assaults in to remove Saddam.
Well, I guess maybe one question is, can we imagine it's possible to get people thinking about the United States as being other than as being a country that exercises power in ways other than military?
I hope so.
Well, I think, David, it's interesting your statement introducing the topic indicated the attacks on America and how Americans felt, etc. One of the things that we sometimes don't think about is that those attacks were felt by people all over the world. And that kind of a severe action was against all the kinds of values people all over the world had. And so there was a great deal of sympathy and feeling of being partnership with America during that period of time. And sometimes we forget that, and I think that's important. And that includes people in Muslim countries as well. So these attacks were in some ways on people all over the world. And so I think it's important for Americans to realize that there is this sense of concern over these sorts of issues, and that it's important to think about how others perceive this. We had Susan Eisenhower on campus a few weeks ago, if you remember. And as I was talking with Susan at dinner, she was saying that one of the interesting things at dinner with her grandfather, President Eisenhower, is he always made them say, okay, what does the other person's perspective on this? What does the other guy think about this, as he put it? That's a quote. And I think sometimes we need to be engaged in that kind of thinking as well as we begin to think about the long-term responses to these sorts of interests and how we can build, again, a world community that addresses some of the great needs that we have that include this terrorism and criminal activity. That's an important perspective to think about other people's views.
Let's talk with some other callers. Let's go to another Champaign person. That's line 1. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir.
Along those lines, foreign policy is number one, and we have to decide whether we're going to lead the world or beat the world into submission. And if we're going to beat it, then we should certainly, the first thing is alter the draft so all people are represented, not just mostly the poor. The National Guard now is really representative of not the whole country at all. It's people that joined because they were hard up. They needed two jobs. So that's the general thought.
I think the call raises a good issue, and I guess it makes me think of something that I have read, and I'm assuming that it is actually true about about our involvement in Iraq particularly, and that is small towns like those around Champaign-Urbana in central Illinois, they are disproportionately affected by the fact that their people often, and it often may end up being firefighters, police officers, and maybe it doesn't even matter if it's people like that. If you're a big city and a certain number of people are called up and they have to go off to serve, you know, you can absorb that. But a much smaller community, that could be a much more serious thing for you. Do you think that that we have to start to think differently about the whole concept of a purely volunteer military?
Well, I was in the Pentagon. I was part of the Department of Manpower for the Marine Corps when we were making the decision to move from a draft force to an all-volunteer force. And we studied what quality issues were. We looked at every cohort for 3 years. A cohort was 40,000 recruits. And we clearly saw that the quality was tied to education, the quality was tied to sense of service. And I had those under my command in the 80s and the 90s. And there is nobody in uniform that has lived in the last 30 years through both draft-based military and an all-volunteer force that would tell you they want to go back to a draft force. Mm-hmm. Now, every community, a community of 1,000 people, how many serve actively in that community? That's a fair question, but it is... If you have 30 volunteers in a community of 1,000 in their fire department or individuals, it's a large number. So we always have been served by those in small numbers who want to serve specific purposes. And others do other things in the community. They may be teachers or business leaders or whatever else. The individuals, and I do take a little exception, quite frankly, a great exception, to those who would characterize those who are serving as, you know, somehow lesser quality people. I object to that. I know those people. I've served with those people. A good friend of mine was a battalion commander in desert in the assaults in, and I met those young men in Camp Lejeune as they left command. I got to tell you, they're as good as we've ever had. My son is in the National Guard, and he doesn't have to be in the National Guard. It's a choice he made. And I serve with the civil support teams here in this state who have committed themselves to help communities in this state by full-time service. I think it's wrong because perhaps we disagree with the president or we disagree with foreign policy to say the young men and women serving are somehow lesser people. Mm-hmm. Now, do you need more of them? We certainly could use more in certain capacities. But I think the quality of them is as good as we've ever had.
Well, I may be mistaken in this, but it seems to me that in this conversation about whether or not we ought to reinstitute a draft, that I thought mostly that was to address the issue of need. That is, that we don't have as many soldiers as we need, and that we're not doing that.
Needed more, I think the budgets would go up. I think what I heard is we need to share the pain. We need national service, and I agree with that. I think every person in this country ought to serve something other than themselves. They can serve in many ways. I've talked to lots of high school groups about service. In every high school, you know, we've got young people who, could you be a volunteer firefighter, or could you help out in Red Cross, and so on, or help out in the school. What you find out is most young people are willing to do things they don't get paid for, but that can make a difference. And I think that's the question for our country is, how do you make a difference in your country without having to get paid for it necessarily?
Let's go on to another call. Let's go to Champaign and line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, briefly, I will say that it's not fair to take people from low middle class who are struggling in this country the only way to get education is to go into the battlefield, and the other people don't have to do it. My main statement was, or question, I'm concerned that we don't have enough domestic security, and I'm worried about places like Clinton Nuclear Plant from the terrorists.
Well, there, I'm afraid we're leaning on Dick Cheney a lot this evening, but this definitely is in your area.
Sure.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, let me talk about it a little bit. First of all, Illinois is one of the best protected in terms of the nuclear power plants. There are actually five or six locations. Some of them are double plants. They are wired directly to the Department of Nuclear Safety. So there is a secondary, every minute they get an update on what's happening in those plants. There are, and I certainly wouldn't divulge specific secrets, but they are part of a state, certainly the state police and the state protection plan. Some of those have been implemented, as you saw on 9/11 when you went to orange or you went to higher levels of alert. And there is a direct relationship between those plants, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and organizations like Argonne Labs that have, if you would, if something catastrophic, an accident happened, can put in containment teams and so on. All of those are in the state. So nuclear reactors, we do have a number of active reactors, and Illinois for a dozen years has been one of the few states that had a Department of Nuclear Safety whose job it was full-time to track what happened in those reactors on a real-time basis.
So you would say that you think we are doing an adequate job,
yes,
providing security for a place like the Clinton plant?
I think the, in particular, the nuclear reactors, the Clinton plant, absolutely.
All right, let's talk with a caller in Clinton on line two. Hello.
Greetings to the panel. This question was partially addressed by the last call, but I'd still like to make it. During the presidential campaign, much has been made of purported funding cuts to the COPS program, etc. And rhetoric aside, what are the panel's members' views as to the current preparedness of first responders, including police and firemen? And I'm interested in that both in respect to the national perspective and as well as the Illinois, and also as to the impact that public policy may have had on this since 9/11.
Well, again, obviously anyone could comment, but again, this is Dick Cheney's area.
Well, I'm happy to. Certainly the COPS program was an important program, still is. There's a firefighter equivalent to that called the SAFER program, which was funded this year for the first time at $100 million that would hire firefighters. Full-time staff is a real issue. Having lots of, 70% of all firefighters in this country are volunteers. That's not true with the police, but there's still, in a small community, there's not a lot of either. Mm-hmm. Tamaroa was a small community in which a railroad derailment caused release of gases, and they had a handful of both firefighters and police officers. What they had to do was get help and get it quickly. And so part of our strategy in the state is to build a robust system of mutual aid. We want regions, and we've designated 19 regions by county, and trying to give them additional capabilities to hold for 2 hours until additional assistance can come. And that assistance has to sustain itself for at least 72 hours until federal assistance can arrive, because those are the timelines that you face. There's no doubt that funding has a direct impact on our equipment, on the number of full-time people you can have in the pipeline to take advanced training, build advanced teams. But there has been investments on the other side in equipment. For example, every firefighter and police officer in the state now has, that wants it, their department wants it, has a gas mask, which gives a sustaining capability for that 2 hours in that warm zone. We've built 70 hazmat and technical rescue teams, and so communications are being put in. That came from federal investment as well. And so There has been a move away from just hiring people to building capability sets. And capability sets are targeted to the risks that communities have. And there's no question that smaller communities don't get a lot of money, because even if you gave them a lot of money, they wouldn't have a lot of capability. But what they have is the ability to reach out and get assistance quickly. Whether that plan makes sense or not to individuals, that's the plan, and it's worked. It's worked in places, like I said, like Utica and recent train derailment south of Decatur. You talk, Decatur isn't a terrorist site, but it had a major train derailment with hydrochloric acid and so on and so forth. Wasn't released, could have. I don't know how else to answer that. I think the COPS program was an important program that put people on the street. It's still an important program, and I would tell you a substantial portion of the Homeland Security funding coming to Illinois is targeted specifically and can only be spent in law enforcement. So law enforcement has a targeted amount of monies that have been spent in their needs.
Did you want?
I'd like to. A while ago, Dick was talking about the long run issues, mm-hmm. and I took it to the short run. I'd like to now take the short run to the long run and say that these are very important measures that Richard is talking about. But in the long run, and in the way in which we're going to find security in a more fundamental sense is by being engaged in this world in a positive and in a leadership way, and that we have to re-engage, it seems to me, at this time, much more productively than we have been. And that's one of the issues that we have with the international student and the international dimension of our university, is that at the very time America needs to be engaged and being a part of these issues and working with people on development and economics and trade and culture, et cetera, we're starting to withdraw in places. And so our natural tendency is to do that. That's when we need to be even more engaged. So I would have a plea for us to think about these longer run issues. There aren't enough policemen. There aren't enough firemen if we have a hostile world. And we've got to find a way to deal with the rest of the world in these more positive ways. Mm-hmm. We have before, and I'm sure we will again, but it's something we need to get at.
Yeah. I want to just invite particularly Hamish back and to address this particular point, and that is what it is we do to address the issue of how it is that we are perceived elsewhere. And now that it maybe not be for us here, I don't know if there's anything that we can do about that, but it's certainly, I think, something that's worth thinking about and talking about.
Well, I think we need to slow down and so not be the charge forward. Like when we've had, the Cold War made it really easy that you had like one football team versus another one and you led from the front. Well, now one of those teams has disappeared and you can't always be the person running from the front all the time. You've got to actually get everyone together. So you've got to support and coach everyone together. And so it's a totally different model that we need to look at and think about how we bring together a community and allow them to flourish, which helps us flourish within that community. And that's just a totally different model and way that we're looking at the world. And many of our foreign policies are based on this old adversarial policy where we were the captain of the team and we're driving forward and we're going to beat the other team. Well, today we don't need to beat the other team. We've got to help them all flourish and come together. And I think that's a big change in thinking about how to do that. Yeah.
And I think Dick brought up an excellent point a minute ago about the fact that we're not talking about government to government so much anymore, as we're talking about individuals, non-governmental organizations, networks, a much more amorphous sort of set of actors rather than just a public sector to public sector relationship. So that's an important element. And one of the issues about the international student body that we've alluded to a bit, but I think is important too, is what an important economic sector that is. It's a $12 billion industry in the United States. It's the fifth largest service export we have. In Champaign-Urbana, international students account for probably $110 million every year into this economy.
We were stunned by that number when we heard that. We looked at it and thought, no, that can't be right. I'm really glad that we got to that point because it really is a very significant. You can think of all the other ways in which they contribute economically, very, very significant.
And I've just come back from a number of meetings in other countries, and I can assure you, I think it was Hamish who had indicated, there's a significant competition in this marketplace for the bright young people in this world. Mm-hmm. And Australia, the UK, Canada, Germany, France, they're all recruiting very, very aggressively for these students. So
you know,
it's an important element.
I'm very sorry to say that we're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. My apologies. We have a couple of people we cannot take. Perhaps in some of our other programming we can get back to some of these issues. For now, though, we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guests, Earl Kellogg. He's Associate Provost for International Affairs at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Hamish Gao, he is Assistant Professor of International Agribusiness, also at the U of I. Richard Janey, he's Director of the Illinois Fire Service Institute. And also our fourth guest is Tom Arkell. He's an attorney. On Thursday night this week, by the way, our election coverage continues with a look at the race for the Illinois House in the 103rd District. John Paul will be your host. That's Thursday night at 7. We hope that you will join us then. For now, thanks for watching, and good night.
You've been listening to By the People, America in the World. Join us Thursday evening at 7 for By the People, Election 2004. This program from WILL-TV, simulcast here on AM 580.